New York's Fighting 69th is one of many National Guard units that has been called up for duty in Iraq. My guest, Sean Michael Flynn, commanded two rifle companies in the 69th and now has written a new book called The Fighting 69th, One Remarkable National Guard Unit's Journey from Ground Zero to Baghdad. The Fighting 69th was famous as a largely Irish unit with a distinguished combat record. But by 2001, Flynn says this unit was a multicultural group comprised largely of immigrants and New Yorkers from the lower economic classes. Flynn writes, most had no prior military experience and no intention of serving their country any longer than it took to get a paycheck or college credit or job training. Their uniforms are often incomplete and worn to look better in the hood than in the wood. Black two-pack bandanas instead of helmets, low-riding camouflage pants, unlaced boots. When they marched, it was more of a pimp roll or gangster limp. If they didn't feel like doing army duties, they'd tell you to stick it. Sean Michael Flynn, welcome to Fresh Air. What was the Fighting 69th's reputation before it was activated in 9/11, after 9/11?
I think some people didn't think the Fighting 69th could get out of its own way. It was underfunded. It was ill-equipped. It was short of soldiers and short of a lot of the key qualified leaders that any military unit needs to have in place to perform effectively.
You write, the unit had allowed too many old, out-of-shape, and drug-using men in its ranks, making whatever accommodations were necessary to keep soldiers on the roll. So what were the men in the ranks like?
Well, that was the opinions of one of the captains that I interviewed for the book. And he had come from another unit where the quality of the soldiers and the equipment was at a higher level. And he was shocked when he came into the Fighting 69th and saw that the soldiers were not of the same caliber.
The way you describe it, most of the men in the Fighting 69th really didn't expect to be called on to defend New York after September 11th, didn't expect to be sent to Iraq. They expected to report for duty, was it once a month?
1 weekend a month and 2 weeks every summer. That's the catchphrase.
Yeah, and hopefully to get some college tuition payments and so on. But, you know, that's not the way it worked out. After September 11th, once the men were called on to participate in the defense of New York, what was the reaction within the Fighting 69th at being, you know, really called on to respond?
Nobody hesitated to respond to September 11th. Everybody was there. This was New York City. This was our backyard. And everybody went to the armory without a call, put their gear together, and worked their way down to Ground Zero with the battalion. But following that, as weeks turned into months, turned into years of homeland security duty in the New York City area and also at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, a lot of the soldiers said, well, wait a minute, now, this isn't what I signed up for. I was there for Ground Zero. I helped that. I was there for 9/11. That was the crisis. But this year of duty is not what I signed up for, and maybe I need to rethink my membership in the National Guard. And about 30% of the soldiers wound up leaving the National Guard at that time.
How did you feel about taking into battle a battalion of men who weren't trained for it and who you describe as being not prepared?
You know, the commander of the 69th had written a newsletter to the force prior to going to Iraq, and he said, don't worry, the Army will prepare us. You will be more prepared for Iraq than you can ever imagine. But in fact, as we got closer to getting on the plane to fly to the Middle East, it occurred to him that we're not ready. We are not as ready as I thought we would be. And that went through the minds, I think, of all the units. We all wanted more training, and we all wanted to be better and have more equipment. You know, more is better, I guess, is what we were thinking. But at the end of the day, we had to go.
What were you lacking in terms of training and equipment?
The equipment actually was not a significant issue. By 2004, when the Fighting 69th went to Iraq, the military-industrial complex had really ramped up to start getting armor and new helmets and body armor out to the soldiers. So we didn't lack in that regard. We got it all new as we were getting ready to go over. What we lacked, though, was the time to train on that equipment because it was coming in so fast. We were never training on it. And, you know, though as an infantry company commander, I may wanted to have trained my men on how to properly attack an insurgent force inside of a building. Instead, I might have to focus on, well, how do we use this new radio that we just got?
So were you in the position of having to explain to the soldiers why they didn't get the training they were promised and why they had to fight anyways?
Yes. All of the leadership in the Fighting 69th found themselves in the middle of Kuwait, getting ready to drive north into the middle of Baghdad for a fight that none of them thought would ever take place, for a mission none of them thought the National Guard would ever do. And the soldiers looked and said, where is the rest of the training that we need to do this? And we had to look at them in the eye and say, we've got what we've got, but we've got to go forward and give it our best.
One of the missions that the Fighting 69th had was in Taji. What was the mission there?
Taji is a rural area about 25 miles north of Baghdad. Like most of the areas around Iraq, it was very heavily canaled for use by farming. It had houses kind of remotely spread out here and there. And the job of the Fighting 69th was essentially to secure that area so that the insurgents didn't go into there and lob rockets and mortars into the big major bases inside of Baghdad. And the 69th was effective. Even without a traditional battle handover like most units were receiving, the 69th was able to go out and just by driving around the roads and putting themselves in the area, that immediately reduced that indirect fire attack. But it certainly created other problems.
Like?
What you might refer to as roadside bombs, which in Taji, we did not have roadside bombs as much as we had roadbed bombs. An explosion did not go off on the side of the road. The entire road blew up with massive amounts of explosive power, far greater than any of our armored vehicles, whether they be armored Humvees or even very heavily armored Bradley fighting vehicles, could resist. The nature of those explosives could defeat absolutely any piece of equipment that the U.S. Army had in Iraq.
What was the worst hit you took?
2 years ago, and this month in 2005, the 69th lost a fully loaded Bradley fighting vehicle with seven soldiers inside. It was driving down a rural road alongside of a canal, a road that we had to use because there were only a handful of roads. So the enemy could probably guess that we would be there, and he did, and he guessed well. And he hit that armored vehicle, destroying it completely, tossing several tons of steel and armor and soldiers through the air till it was upside down in a canal. And it was such a powerful charge that, very much like September 11th, we had to use ultimately DNA samples to confirm the casualties on board that vehicle.
What was the reaction of the men to this attack? I mean, these were men who hadn't signed up for full service in the military. They just signed up for the National Guard. And after an attack like this, where you can't even identify the remains of the soldiers, did they want to continue fighting or did they feel like, why are we here?
I think you saw a little bit of both. In that first 2 months of combat in Iraq, the Fighting 69th lost 10 soldiers. And several men had to decide whether or not they were going to be able to handle this. Some men cracked under the pressure and had to be reassigned or taken out of key positions. After we lost the Bradley, even the commander of the Fighting 69th was shaken to the point where he said, I wasn't sure that I could send the unit back out into the field, because he believed that sending one more patrol outside into rural Iraq was a death sentence for the soldiers. It was the soldiers themselves who walked into his office and said, sir, we're going to go back out, and we're going to go back out hard. And I think there's a point in warfare where soldiers realize that they could die at any moment. And the men of the 69th realized very quickly that they could die at any moment, and they had two choices. They could either get over it, or they could curl up into a fetal position and no longer perform.
So were they successful in striking back?
They were, but success is always limited in insurgent warfare. You know, it's not as if you were taking a line, or, you know, we've captured such and such a town, and the enemy is now on the other side of the river. It's not as clear-cut as that. What the Fighting 69th did to respond was pour every single soldier and piece of equipment they had into that area of Taji. They went without sleep. They went without rest for days and days and days, and beat the brushes, asking, trying to find out where the enemy was, and trying to stay so omnipresent that the enemy did not have a chance to strike back. It was a successful operation because, again, they were not attacking the big bases with mortars and rockets, and it reduced their amount or their ability to attack the 69th with IEDs.
My guest is Sean Michael Flynn, author of the new book, The Fighting 69th. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Sean Michael Flynn, author of the new book, The Fighting 69th. Flynn commanded two rifle companies in the Fighting 69th, a New York National Guard unit that he describes as undertrained and under-equipped for battle. But in 2004, they were sent to Iraq, where, among other things, they fought insurgents in Taji, near Baghdad. After Taji, the Fighting 69th was assigned to guard the road that became known as the most dangerous road in the world, the road from the Baghdad airport to the Green Zone. And it sounds like that was actually a very transformative experience for the Fighting 69th. In what way?
The battalion entered Iraq lacking the training that it fully wanted, and it had all that on-the-job combat training, which was a very costly way to go to war in Iraq. By the time we got to Route Irish, however, that we now had the training, and the Fighting 69th was at the least on par with any other active duty battalion now serving in Iraq. So the unit and the men who were so concerned in Kuwait, who were scared about the unit's level of training and who were scared about its leadership, now had a chance to see the unit fully trained and to have seen its leaders, those that made it through Taji, functioning. And they now had confidence in themselves and confidence in their leadership. And they did not have that confidence going into Iraq. It was only 3 months into the war that that confidence started to reach the soldiers. And that took place on Route Irish, and it made the Fighting 69th a very effective combat unit. And the men took a lot of pride in their capabilities on that road.
During the period that you write about, which ends in 2006, how many men did the Fighting 69th lose in Iraq?
19 soldiers out of approximately 750. And another 85 were wounded. And those are fairly steep numbers for this war, and perhaps among the highest in any National Guard unit that deployed overseas. It was a costly fight. And those are just the combat casualties, because back at home, the war took its toll on the people as well. Two of my platoon leaders, in fact, lost their marriages during that time period. And that was a regular occurrence throughout the battalion. So whatever stresses people had at home were exacerbated by the war. So the casualties from that tour were high.
How have the men who are under your command done since returning home?
They've done very well. Certainly, some soldiers have had some issues. You know, there are some soldiers who have signs of post-traumatic stress disorder, and who are being treated for that. But the number is very small, and there are some soldiers who are wounded, some severely, who are doing great. I had a soldier that worked very closely with me, who lost the use of his left arm and most of his left arm in the process, and he's now running triathlons. And I'm impressed. They're not just even Paralympic triathlons, but these are triathlons that you and I are running, and he's placing, and he only has the use of one of his arms. So it's, you know, so the soldiers are doing great across the board, in my opinion, though I don't think a day goes by where any of them think about their tour and think about the cost and the their friends that they left behind.
Is there any chance that the men who serve with you from the National Guard Battalion of the Fighting 69th will be redeployed and sent back to Iraq?
More than 300 soldiers of the Fighting 69th are, as we speak, headed towards Afghanistan or about to head towards Afghanistan. Among those soldiers are men who served at Ground Zero, who did homeland defense duty in and around the United States, who went to Iraq, and they're now going on to Afghanistan. Every soldier who served in Iraq in the Fighting 69th and who is now going to Afghanistan volunteered to go.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks so much, Terry. It's been my pleasure.
Sean Michael Flynn is the author of The Fighting 69th. He's now a captain in the Army National Guard.